You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of April 7th, 2021. And today we learn once again to never fight a stranger in the Alps.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Jester.
And I'm George Albor.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. And this week, we got them. We got video games.
Some of them. We got some of them.
We got we've played many video games. We finished fewer of them.
That's correct, yes. And I will personally finish fewer of them, I guess, for the next 18 years of my life, starting this Thursday.
Yeah, it's pretty much, from here on out, you will go through a, George, welcoming first child into the world this week.
This coming week, yep.
You will go through a very strange and very tiring phase where you actually can finish a lot of games because there will be a baby sleeping on you and only sleeping when you are awake and moving.
Nice.
So you'll just be like frantically trying to stay awake, which means that you might finish a lot of games, and then once the baby is a little bit bigger, then you'll be living that Scott Jester lifestyle.
What game is playable? Like can I do Bloodborne?
Oh hell yeah. With headphones?
Yeah.
I mean, I will say this, my children, because they're maniacs, would really only sleep if being held or in the front pack for a good chunk of their first months, and so really the name of the game was staying awake while they slept so I wouldn't accidentally fall on top of them and crush them. So
yes, exactly.
It was definitely a lot of console gaming, because it's much easier to play it with a controller than a keyboard and mouse, and then I mean that's when I played all that Hades.
Yeah.
Like hundreds, dozens and dozens, like 150 runs of Hades, but just all played within the hours of 1 and 4 in the morning.
Yeah. I feel like something like Bloodborne would be good, because you have to have quick response. Well, but then on the other hand, I will die a lot.
Oh, yeah. So. Your response time will be shot, but you might also, you'll glean further knowledge of the horror of the occult because of the sleep deprivation.
Yes. This is where I think I need to really like load up all those games that I have finished and talk shit about, like
Scott, the Lego series is actually a masterpiece.
This is the time where I truly transform.
But we have a handful of games this week.
We do.
We've at least dabbled in a few, and some mostly recent. I have one older game, but we'll get to that one in a sec. But I'm interested in, speaking of horror, I'm interested in this latest horror game that you were playing.
Yeah, so I just finished a game called Mundane, which is a game from a studio called Hidden Fields out of Lucerne, Switzerland, which I assume is where Lucerne cheese comes from. This is a horror game that is really like a folkloric horror game. And I think the strongest comparison I could think of was to something like Year Walk, which was an old game by old by our standards, by Samogo. I don't even know if Samogo exists anymore. They used to mostly make mobile games. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened to them? Mm. Anyway, Year Walk was a kind of a horror game based off of this like ritual called Arsgang that I assume the Swiss also did. And Mundane is kind of like a Swiss fairy tale. It is entirely in black and white. Yeah. And the basic premise is that you are going up to this mountain village where your grandfather has recently died when his house burned down. And something seems off. So you're basically going to investigate. And what you uncover is a very like strange, atmospheric horror story about an event during some war where they made a pact with a creepy old man that may or may not be the devil. And it is a short game. I mean, there's not a whole lot to it. It's also not that scary. Like I call it a horror game because that's how it's marketed.
Yeah.
There's exactly one jump scare which I will admit did get me. I did scream aloud. But the rest of the game is very like mellow, and it's just you really kind of taking in the kind of weird, unsettling nature of the world. Yeah. I think the thing that stands out the most is the visual design of the game, because everything is hand-drawn. Like the walls, the brick textures, all of the enemies. When you look in a mirror, the character's face is hand-drawn. Like everything is hand-drawn.
Yeah. And but it's also polygonal, so it has this really weird vibe, like a very artistic-looking N64 game or something.
Yeah, they basically hand drew all the textures, and then everything is layered on top of that. And you get some weird things where like an eye will look slightly off.
Right.
But that's exactly right for the atmosphere.
Right.
And everything being black and white and sepia toned has the feel of being hand drawn in a notebook, which you yourself are carrying around and drawing in as well as a character. So there's this great doubling of like the world that you're the sort of fictional folkloric world is being told to you and experienced in the sort of same way that it's written. You know, it is a hand-drawn experience. But it's really cool. I really quite liked it. I'm surprised because there's really not much to write home about in regards to any one thing being stellar. Like, I don't think the movement or traversal around the world is great. There's nothing to write home about in regards to the challenge of like fighting the enemies, for example.
I was actually going to ask that. Like this, it kind of looks like almost like an adventure game, but is it actually? Yes. Is there some sort of action component to it?
So, a little bit. So there are three stats that you have on your character that you can improve as you play. So if you can puzzle out a way to, for example, make coffee, you can increase your sanity. Uh-huh. Still not sure what the sanity meter does, but when you're around enemies, it causes your screen to like do weird things.
Right.
Eventually, you unlock a rifle, and you can actually kill enemies. Mm. But the aim is really slow. You're likely going to miss, and you have to reload. So it's generally not a great tactic anyway.
Right.
And then some of the enemies, like the first one you encounter, which are these like weird hay people. Mm-hmm. They're like bundles of hay, but they have faces poking out of the hay.
Yeah.
And they'll slowly walk over to you. And as they walk over to you, if you get too close, your hand will start to burn. Like you'll catch on fire and you'll start becoming hay.
Ah.
And so you can burn them. So there are piles of hay along the map that eventually you need to like load into a truck. So it kind of makes sense, right? Like there's little hay clumps piled around. If you find any of them standing near one, you can light like a further one on fire and it'll catch up to the enemy and kill the enemy that way.
Nice.
So there is like some little puzzling out how you can kill the enemies. More often than not, you're kind of in stealth mode, so you can crouch and sort of go past them, or you can take a long way around, or you can just book it. Like there's not really a health meter that you're tracking. You can generally just run away from the enemies. So they're really just more there to give this like sort of weird, creepy tone. Right. There's one enemy in particular that looks like a Sasquatch, or you know how the weird, what is it, Krampus?
I was about to say, I'm getting strong Krampus vibes off this.
Yes, it looks like Krampus because it's got like this fucked up horns and like a weird face. And I like snuck up behind Krampus and I was like, I'm going to fucking get this Krampus guy once and for all. And I shot my rifle, and then I see the little text on the screen appear that says, some enemies cannot be harmed. And then Krampus just fucking turns around and charges at me. Very, very terrifying in that one particular moment.
It definitely has a... There's some sort of kind of Northern European, like post-Gothic vibe to this whole thing.
Yeah.
Very unsettling.
The language, which we discovered before recording, is called Romanche.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds super weird and, like, kind of fictional. And I think one of the things that I like the most about the game is that I think a folklore game done right, kind of like Hellblade, right? Mm-hmm. Which we talked about from a folkloric perspective when we debriefed on that game many years ago.
Yeah.
There's an ability to sort of walk this line where you take the fiction of that world at face value, right? Like everything feels real and authentic to that folkloric experience, because in the realm of the video game space, it is real.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think creating something that is atmospheric, right? And where there are like notes and connotations that reference this like old man and these events that took place in the past where it was basically like a deal with the devil. Mm-hmm. But you get the sense that this is this region's own version of the devil. Like, this might be a folklore story that you have your grandfather tell you as a little kid. Like, oh, you know, one time, you know, I knew a guy who sold a soul to the devil at a bar for, you know, change to make a phone call or something like that, right? Like, that's kind of how these stories are spun. And that's how this world is built. And that's how this story is spun. But then on top of that, there's also a lot of like Christian imagery. There's a church and a priest that you talk to. And at one point you're like holding a cross up to this demon. And, and in a lot of these spaces, and certainly for some older folklore that are sort of amalgamations or shifts of like much older folklore that have been influenced by Christianity and, and Catholicism, you get this like interesting melds, right? Where like demons are real and folkloric like creatures are real, but also Christianity holds a power against them, you know? So there's like some fun like play around that. And it, overall, I think it's just a really cool experience. And I think we only get games like this that really sort of lean into the folklore, I don't know, maybe like once every couple years. And I think if you're at all interested in playing a game like that, I think this is a really good one. This is a very strong contender for a game that justifies or really showcases the type of experience you can craft when you just really lean into and pull heavily on just existing stories, like existing folklore, existing aesthetic, you know? Because even something like, you know, God of War, like it has a lot of references to mythology, but it is its own thing, clearly, right? As opposed to really just being heavily defined by the sort of single sort of mythological experience.
The Hellblade comparison is interesting too, because, and not to like go down the full like anthropology dork rabbit hole, but I mean, I think those types of games, and it sounds like this one does it similar, they illustrate the role that that sort of mythology takes in a in kind of a like pre-scientific method world. You know, like this is the reality of the society, and you know, it plays by the rules of the mythos, and and video games are good at that because they're 100% systems based, so you know, you have to interact with the system of the myth on, you know, the player level as well as the story level, which I think helps reinforce that. Whereas if you're just reading about something, it's harder to put yourself in that scenario where the magic is just as much of a reality as what we would consider like empirical fact, because, you know, we just live in that world. Whereas if you're in a game, it's simulating. The line between those things is blurry, which means you can like directly feel it. So I just think games are like subtly very good at that sort of thing. Like what would it be like to live in a world where that mythology has a much more practical implication to your day to day? And like, that's
exactly,
you know, that just kind of, it is a taste of what it could feel like.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like there's one cool little thing that they do, again, the drawing aesthetic leans into this as well, but there are parts of the story that are fundamental to like paintings, right? And drawings, like that is part of the story because there's like actual power over it. I mean, there's all kinds of like other spoiler stuff to do with the events of the past and things like that. But there are often drawings in the world, and if you look at them, the game will slowly zoom into the drawing, and you'll start to hear audio. Like, let's say you're zooming into kids playing in the snow. It'll slowly zoom in, and then you'll hear the sound of children like playing in the snow.
Oh, that's cool.
Rising as you zoom in.
Yeah.
And there are different elements in the game where doing that results in a change. So one, eventually you unlock a vehicle to sort of drive around the map. There are posters around the world that are like ads for this vehicle. And if you look at them, the car will slowly appear drawn on the page. And once it's fully drawn on, that's when the car shows up right outside. So that's how you spawn the vehicle.
Oh, that's cool.
Small little touch, but again, it does connect to the reality of this little mythology that they're spinning about the power of drawn realities, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. It's exciting to, I think this is going to be the pattern for the rest of the year of unexpected independent games that are weirdly able to survive the kind of destructive nature of the pandemic in terms of development, you know?
Yep. Yeah, for sure. I will say this game's $20, which I think is probably a little steep for a lot of people just looking for like a short indie horror game. So maybe people want to wait it out for a sale. But I would say I think it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about another indie game that's been out for a little bit, but we just haven't had a chance to talk about on the show. Loop Hero.
Yes, Loop Hero.
Yeah, I've played some of this game. I mean, this is one of those games where it seems like there is an ending, but it's a long-term game based off of the kind of run-based nature. But man, fuck, how to describe this game? So it is a procedurally generated game where there are some kind of RPG-esque things where if you encounter enemies, you do a turn-based fight against them, except that everything... Except
there are no turns.
yeah, except that the one big thing is the entire game is on an automated cycle where the world that you're on is a loop, and you're just kind of making your way around the loop, and different tiles that you land on have different effects or different enemies or what have you. But your character just continues to walk around the loop automatically. When a fight starts, you just fight automatically. You start to pick up items and crafting materials automatically, and you basically have to intervene in order to make a choice about your equipment or to build something new on the map or what have you. It's very hard to describe, but pretty easy to pick up once you start.
I mean, honestly, I think the best comparison or the best game style to think about when you're thinking about something like Loop Hero are deck building games.
Yes.
Is it Darkest Dungeon? That's a deck builder of sorts, like a tile deck building game.
I think you might be thinking of a different one.
This is not Slay the Spire, is it? Or no, there's like an assassin one. Whatever. There are other games that are in this similar genre digitally, but even from the purely board game perspective, right?
Yeah.
When you are making your loops, you go into a loop with a deck of cards, and every loop you will be drawing from that deck of cards, and those cards are essentially tiles that you lay on the map that will augment the type of enemies that you encounter as you're going through each loop.
Yeah.
In addition to augmenting the enemies, it augments the rewards that you get to contribute towards the sort of wider campaign goal when you come back from this little adventure, because you're going to be building out your town and whatnot. And as you lay more tiles, the game becomes more challenging, but you also get better loot, more rewards, rinse, wash, repeat until you defeat the boss of that particular level.
Yeah.
Or when you say, okay, I've had enough, I'm going to call it quits and go back to my base and sort of invest. And then there are a bunch of different classes you can unlock as well based upon the things that you're building in your settlement to then augment your abilities or, you know, change up your cards that you're going into your next run with.
There's a bit of a... the metagame reminds me a little bit of XCOM or something like that, or even what's the Rogue Legacy, where you're able to kind of augment your abilities, but you're going back to build on a meta base, and then try out different cards that interact differently, which I thought was I generally do not play deck building games. But this one, I think, for my tastes, was limited enough. You know, you're only going out there with, I don't know, 15 different cards or something like that. Like, so,
a lot of them are duplicates.
Exactly. They're duplicates, or it's very clear what they do, where it's like this, the meadow card gives you extra HP every time you do a loop or something. And so they're not complicated to think about, but there are a lot of different and unexpected dynamics to them where, if you put enough boulder and mountain cards together, it'll form a peak, and a peak spawns harpies. The harpies do other things on the map. So you can start to cascade these different things. And, one of the things that I finally understood was there's a card that lets you get rid of objects on the map. Which
game changer.
It's itself is super, because some things are very good to have at first, but then it starts to get overwhelming, and it's like, I have to stop this mountain from spawning harpies, so I'm going to remove it,
Well, it's also one of the few ways that you can sort of intentionally create spaces where you're getting kinds of resources. So
yes.
for example, when you build a town, you can then lay wheat fields next mm-hmm. to those little villages. But yeah. if you remove the village, the wheat fields become barren because there's no villagers to harvest.
Right, yeah.
And so then skeletons start appearing or like something different changes in that space. And you can use that sort of like oblivion card or what have you to intentionally either make the board easier, per your point, like get rid of some of the things that spawn there like as a surprise, or like intentionally make a space more challenging because you know that's sort of the area where you're going to be investing in along your loop.
Yeah, that's where you're going to find that material that will then contribute to the meta base and all of that stuff, which I found that whole dynamic pretty cool because it's so funny because you can very quickly, you get to the end of a loop and you have to decide, should I call it quits here and take all of my resources with no penalty and go back to the base, or should I try to make another loop? And so it's a fun challenge because what seems pretty straightforward, where it's like, oh yeah, I could totally make another loop, but then you realize, oh, I haven't thought about the fact that, you know, I have that, I did get rid of that village, which means there's going to be a lot more skeletons, and also it's about to do a day-night cycle, which means these other rats are going to spawn, and also, you know, I got rid of my regenerating health thing. And so, like, what seems very obvious is actually sometimes kind of deceptively easy or deceptively difficult, where it's like you think you can just make another quick loop, but then you realize, oh crap, there's a bunch of weird exponentially growing shit that I didn't think about here.
Yep.
And then you're just scrambling to make it throughout.
Like, oh god, I hope I make it back to base. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I've definitely had some god tier runs where I was like, I am an unstoppable beast. but I feel like most of the time I was very much questioning whether or not I should push my luck.
Well, and also there are so many different items that you pick up along the loop. You know, there were definitely times where I was holding on to something and I was like, I know this is a good item, but I have a really good vampiric build going right now, and I just seem to be, you know, respawning. But then, you know, it's a house of cards. You know, you replace one item and you realize, ah, crap, I replaced the thing that was the linchpin of me regenerating health automatically, and now I am in much bigger trouble than I thought I was at the very beginning of this loop.
Yeah, for sure. Because at first, it's very easy to fall into the trap of just, oh, I got an orange item. Orange is better than blue. Let me wear the orange thing.
Yeah.
But it's not really building towards your strength of the particular class that you're playing as.
Yeah. I wonder, because it gets to me anyway, it gets kind of tough. And so I was questioning as to how much further I was going to go into it, because it seems like, weirdly enough, it's not just a a run-based game without any story. There's somewhat of a FTL type story behind the scenes in this thing, you know?
And that story, I think, for me, was driving me to play the game, but I stopped after the game crashed while I was on a god run and it lost a lot of stuff. And I think to me, like, that, now, one, it was frustrating for sure, but I think I just decided I don't think I like this game very much. I see why people do, for sure. Yeah. But, you know, my understanding is that originally the developers, Four Quarters, made this game based upon like a game jam they had done for a zero player game. Like, they wanted to see what it was like to make a game where no one played it.
Oh, right.
And so the hero was just going around the track and they were just like changing things around it. And I can see that Loop Hero is the natural conclusion to that thought process, right? Yeah. And for people who genuinely enjoy deck building board games, of which I am not one of them, this just feels too minimally interactive. There's just not enough for me to do during a given loop that it feels like I'm just watching my hero go around a clock. It's a little bit too close to Cookie Clicker for my comfort.
Yes. You know? Yeah, there is definitely a trapping of a clicker game in here.
Yeah, and I think if you can't get past that, like if... And I understand that one of the joys of this for some people is you can kind of play it in the background. Like, you can be watching a TV show, have it on your other screen, and every now and then you got to check in on your hero, because the game will stop automatically if you want it to every time you're done with a fight. So you can change your gear, click start, and it will continue along the way. But there just came a point, and it was right after I lost everything, where it almost, like, by losing all of my shit, it showed me how futile the effort was to just go through it, right? The prospect it opened my eyes. Of having to hope that I have another God tier run where I'm just watching my character do something when I'm not involved, I just had zero interest in it. So I put in maybe, like, I don't know, a good chunk of time, like probably, I don't know, 4 hours, like several hours into this game before I decided I don't think I'm going to go back to it. It's just there's not enough meat on those bones. But I do understand that a lot of people really find a lot to love in the game.
It's kind of, I feel like it's gotten a weird, a super dedicated following in the way that a lot of roguelikes get, you know?
Yeah. I mean, part of it is the aesthetics, you know?
Yeah.
It looks like the pixelated, dark, atmospheric roguelike you would expect from the genre, you know? Yeah. Like, yeah. I think it really does play into that. And it's Devolver Digital that's the publisher. Like, it makes sense that that's what they're doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, good on. I mean, Devolver is. It just seems like they're filling a niche that is bringing interesting games still, you know.
And market. The music is great. Like, for sure, I think the music is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a very strong kind of early 90s PC adventure game vibe to the whole thing.
You know, I do also think that if the town building system was more easily digestible, maybe I would have liked it more. Like, if there was maybe more meat on those bones in particular. But as you build up, it's kind of a mess to really understand what's going on in your town.
It is, you know? It's like, cluttered visually.
Yeah, like, it's not fucking Animal Crossing. Like, the town itself are cluttered tiles with different, like, things on them that you have to, like, look up to understand. Okay, well, if I want to, like, advance this mine. And then there are systems in place in the town where if certain town tiles are next to each other, it will change things. Right. And you can obliterate parts of your town as well. And there's just, there's enough complications there, and it's indecipherable enough and separate enough from the actual gameplay of going around the loop that to me, it just adds another layer of complexity that feels unnecessary to me. That isn't actually what I want to be doing in this game.
It is pretty distinct, you know, it's pretty separate from the main, you know, the action part of the game.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I, let's see, I'll take a couple minutes and talk about the new addition to my family.
Ooh.
A PlayStation 5.
Oh, snap. the proudest, the son you're the most proud to have.
Still heavier and larger than my daughter. Yes, I held both in my arms at the same time to compare. And man, that thing is big.
Yeah, you do not want to drop either of them.
No. But I mean, if I dropped the baby, she would cry. If I dropped the PS5, it would crack my floor.
You would cry.
Yeah, thanks to our friend Tim for scouting a PS5 for me. And so I you know, set that up and have started monkeying around with it. And I played through the... A real throwback of a game called Astro's Playroom.
Yeah, I played a little bit of that too. That's a cool game.
A throwback in that one, there is a game bundled into that system, which is, you know, something that is pretty rare. And two, it opened my eyes to how long we've had PlayStations, because the whole thing is a just exquisite love letter to the PlayStation brand.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think they did Astro's Playroom for every Sony launch, though, right? For every big hardware? There's some kind of Astro's game?
I don't know how far it goes, but I don't know how far it goes back, but it's definitely, it's now a known quantity that happens, you know, with Sony stuff.
So did you think that it was a good showcase of what the PlayStation can do?
I mean, I thought it was pretty cool, especially what it struck me as almost it was a game, and it actually I thought it was a pretty good game all in all. It was a 3D platformer basically, but it seemed like a proof of concept and a tech demo, and not in a mean way, but just in here's what you can do with this new hardware, including the controller. You know, there's just some cool stuff where they're using that same tech that, you know, is in your iPhone and is in your Nintendo Switch excuse me, where you know, the haptic feedback is just a lot more nuanced than it's ever been. And so when you're walking on sand, it feels different than when you're walking on ice. And when you're, you know, climbing hand over hand up a wall. They're doing things with the resistance on the triggers. And there's just a lot of stuff going on in that controller. And they pair it very smartly with the speaker so that it tricks your brain. Your brain puts more investment into both the audio fidelity and the haptic fidelity because they're combining the two things every time. So you hear like the crunch of ice at the same time where you're hearing a crunchier rumble on the controller, and it just enhances both things, which I thought was a very clever little thing that they put in there.
The problem that we will inevitably have is that this will be the singular best use of that technology for the next 4 to 5 years.
It is. It did make me think. I mean, my first thoughts were basically the big Sony first parties, you know, what is Naughty Dog going to do with this? What's it going to look like? Horizon Zero Dawn or what was it called? Journey, you know, Gateway to the West or whatever they're calling the second one. Because it's an exclusive feature to the console, you know, like it is extra work to do that stuff when you're not necessarily going to have to do that work for your PC or Xbox port. So it's just kind of it's a strange thing.
Yeah, but you're right. It's very cool. It definitely stands out.
There's just so much PlayStation reverence in this game, you know, and they just really love it. You know, every time you get like a little artifact, it's like a lovingly 3D rendered model of, you know, the PlayStation 3 camera or something. And there's like a little pun that, you know, goes along with everything that you collect. And in the world, there are little Astrobots acting out famous scenes from other PlayStation console games. You know, you'll see one with like a
Kratos punching Zeus in the face.
No, bloody. You do. Like, there's like straight up God of War references, or there's Ape Escape references, or there's one where there was a little Astrobot with a pyramid head dragging another little Astrobot away.
Oh, dear God. What? That is horrifying.
There's just everything. Like, there's all of the... And then it just made me think a lot about that we've had PlayStations for, like, since the mid-90s now, and there's just been a lot of lore behind the PlayStation franchise.
Yeah.
To the point where... I'm going to spoil the end of Astrobot's Playroom here.
The expanded universe, right?
Yeah.
The PCU?
Yeah, exactly. So the last boss of this game is the dinosaur from the tech demo from the PlayStation 1.
Sweet.
So it's
we
like
always knew he'd come back.
It's just so crazy. I mean, like, they really went deep with all of the, like, weird old tech demos that many people probably didn't even play or that were shown at E3 or whatever. And they just created a mini little museum to the PlayStation brand that I was really not expecting. I was not expecting to find as charming as I thought it was, but the people doing this clearly had a reverence for the material, you know?
We talked about like game museums not too long ago on the podcast, but I would love to see this kind of thing done more, you know?
Yes.
I mean, even within a singular franchise.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked to death over the years about how video games don't do enough like commentary tracks or interactive commentary tracks in particular. This is kind of another way of doing that, you know, paying homage, but creating a new experience on top of it.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Yeah. Anyway, it was just a neat introduction, and I'm, you know, kind of tinkering around with other games on the console now. And I mean, I'm also just appreciative that I can lay my PS4 to rest and the jet engines have finally subsided, you know, for the foreseeable
R.I.P.
future. Yeah. All right. Maybe before we go, we do a quick dip into It Takes Two.
Yeah. Quick thoughts on It Takes Two, which is Joseph Fares' new game.
Yes.
Two-player game, just like the last one, A Way Out.
Yes.
Where two people must be playing at all times, couch co-op or online.
Yeah.
We played only, what, like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours?
I feel like we got out. I mean, we were trying to guess as to how far we are, and we both realized that maybe we're not as far as we thought, but
not long far enough.
We got out of the first stage, it seems like, which is the tool shed, basically.
I have had a few discussions over the past couple years about A Way Out, and apparently a lot more people like that game than I thought, because I think that game is bad. I don't like that game.
That it's just so crazy, because I've heard the same thing, and it just makes me feel crazy, where it's like, I mean, Sure.
Are the we game... wrong?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, and then I think like, no, it is the children that are wrong.
I mean,
you
maybe
know?
We like... bring the worst out of it, out of each other, you know, because part of me, like when you and I are playing, right, you'll criticize something and I'll be like, yeah, you know, like we really will bounce off each other when we're critiquing a game live together.
Right.
Like, that's a different experience. It's why playing Call of Duty many years ago was a joy, right? Like that happens. And then when we joke around because the game is being stupid,
right?
Like it naturally continues, right? So I wonder what it would have been like had we say like played online with a random who's not on mic or something. I don't know. Maybe that would have been different.
But it's the whole like those games are nearly impossible to play without talking to someone. Like it's a weird dynamic, you know. Like your partner's experience will inevitably be part of your own, you know.
Well, I mean, so this is my problem with It Takes Two and A Way Out right now as well. Is I actually don't think the game leans heavily enough into the fact that it's a two-player experience. Like, there should be asymmetric information, but most of the time we're on the screen with each other at the same time. Or if I'm relying on you, you don't need my assistance. I'm just waiting for you to execute. I just don't think it actually leans, at least in the first couple hours, very heavily into the opportunity that I think asymmetric multiplayer games allow. The very fact that despite playing online, our screens are split does not make any fucking sense to me.
It is kind of funny. I mean, I don't know. Part of that could just be because there's no pinging system. If you're trying to describe to someone, hey, throw the nail here or jump to this platform, it's kind of hard to describe that if you're not going to input some sort of in-universe marking, you know?
I just played three co-op games with a friend called We Were Here, which like are on Steam. And every single one of those games, that is the game. The challenge is me describing to you, and it encourages us to have open communication and be creative with our communication. That's what my expectations were going from playing We Were Here to It Takes Two.
Right.
Was thinking, you know, if this is going to be a game about a married couple who are getting a divorce and they're falling out, and I assume it's going to be a lesson about communication, then make communication a fundamental aspect of gameplay, not whether or not you can dodge a hammer faster than your friend.
I mean, who knows? Maybe, you know, I would imagine we have at least two more stages to play. You know, maybe there will be a more distinct separation in one of those, you know?
For sure. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, the game could turn around. When asked what I thought about the game so far, my answer was, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think they do... I mean, even just purely mechanically and visually, it's already better than A Way Out.
Oh, for sure. I love the way that the game will transform one of your screens into a side-scrolling platformer seamlessly. Yeah. That's a really cool effect.
Yeah. And so, I mean, they're already... From a pure base gameplay perspective, they're already doing more interesting things. And I think just overall, just visually, artistically, it is way more interesting.
Yep.
I am quite nervous to see where they go with the story, but I guess we'll have to see how that lands.
Yeah, that's true. There's some weird like squirrel military and like a sexy Latin book that just is not landing where it needs to land. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, and also just already divorce is a pretty fraught subject, and you know, they tried to tackle some pretty fraught subjects with A Way Out, and it was just, remember that whole basketball scene
in A Way Out? Where yes,
it was supposed to be like a touching, heartfelt thing.
Yeah, I think like I was in a truck yelling or something, and like you were looking for a basketball. Yeah. Ugh.
I mean, I'm still looking forward to playing the rest of it just for the novelty's sake, but I mean, it's just so funny to see this like sub genre of things that like they continue to take swings at, you know?
Yeah. And this particular guy, you know, with a particularly decent sized budget. And look, I love that Joseph Fares is just like, I don't really give a fuck what other people are doing in video games. Frankly, I don't even think Joseph Fares likes video games that much, which is fine by me. Like, I think more people should make games who don't like games. I'm just not the biggest fan of his work thus far.
Yeah, it'll be cool to see the end of that game, but yeah, you know, we shall see.
Well, yeah, because we'll probably not have a podcast next week.
Most likely not. Things will get a little loosey-goosey.
Yes.
You know, maybe I'll try to keep the feed going with various updates as we go. But you are embarking on the greatest game.
The most dangerous game. Well, hopefully next time we do a podcast, we could, you know, we could finish our way out. I'll need to play some or a way out. It takes two.
Yes. So. Yeah.
And maybe I'll learn a powerful parenting lesson from that game.
It's like step one, don't take any relationship advice from some weirdo talking book.
Yeah. That's good. That's very good. I have been taking advice from books, but none of them have tried to hit on me, so
all right, well, we will leave it there for this week. experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is our website. You can find more of the podcast wherever you find audio. Do us a favor, leave us a review, tell a friend, and we will be back as soon as we can.
Yes, we will. All right, everyone, until we talk next, thank you for listening.
Ciao.